Hey, good afternoon, Juneau. It's just a second or two before 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon, and I have a great lineup of guests for you today. Folks are getting together, two bands, the Elastic String Band and the Link Union from Lebanon, Missouri, are coming together, and they're going to be doing a concert Sunday night at the Jack. So we'll have a couple of folks from there. Scott Baxter will be in the studio in a while to talk about the Aurora Project. C.B. Bernard has written a new book called Chasing Alaska, and we'll gather up with him. He's down in Seattle. We'll talk to him by phone, and then we'll have some folks that are going to be at the Jack at 5:30 tonight for Food Truck Friday this week. So stay tuned for the rest of Juneau Afternoon. National Native News is next.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Department of Energy says high levels of uranium at a contaminated site on the Wind River Reservation may not flush out of the groundwater naturally in 100 years, like previously thought. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhurov reports.
Tailings from a uranium mill that functioned at the Riverton Uranium Mill Tailings Radiation Control Act site in the 1960s left the area's groundwater with high levels of uranium. The Department of Energy took over management of the site in the late 80s. DOE initiated additional data collection at the site after a flood in 2010 caused uranium levels to spike even higher. In a new report, the agency says it's not totally clear where the uranium that caused those spikes came from. Site manager Bill Dam says further data collection will be needed to understand how to proceed.
Before the flood, we didn't know what the soil concentrations were to start with. And so our hope is that the flood removed a lot of that uranium that was in the soil. But what we're saying now is the concentrations we saw after the flood, you know, we collected in August 2012, may not have been high enough, and we're going to keep looking for additional sources.
The report makes recommendations for potential future work, but Dam says additional data collection will also require a larger budget, something Congress will have to approve. He says the DOE will work with the tribes and their environmental office to figure out the next steps. For National Native News, I'm Irina Zhurov.
Congress has approved $25 million for existing regional water projects, including tribal ones. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
In thirsty parts of the western U.S., water is very difficult to come by. Several regional water construction efforts have slowed or stopped in the past few years due to federal budget cuts. But the Bureau of Land Management has been appropriated $25 million to divide among six projects in South and North Dakota, Montana, and New Mexico. The BLM will decide the split, but will give priority to tribal projects in its decision. Troy Larson with Southeast South Dakota's Lewis and Clark Regional Water System says it's difficult to tell how much each project will receive. Larson says there's no construction work going on in his system this year, and without additional funding, there'll be no work next year either. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
The leader of a harvest camp in Wisconsin wants to expand it. The areas where an iron ore mine is proposed. Mike Simonson reports.
The Lacouderie Harvest Camp has big plans. Tribal elder Melvin Gasper is organizing the five-acre site so they can hunt fish and gather food, as well as educate the public. Now he wants the 5 acres to become 35 acres, adding room to harvest maple syrup.
We're going to have two different maple sugaring processes going on.
Gasper says this is their way of occupying an area where an open-pit iron ore mine is proposed by Gogebic Taconite, and he plans to keep it occupied through 2018. Legally, the harvest camp is in a gray area. They've gotten a one-year variance from Iron County to operate, but beyond that, it's uncertain. The Treaty of 1837 gives them the right to hunt, fish, and gather in the ceded territory of northern Wisconsin, but one tribal official says they may need Iron County's permission to get it expanded. Meanwhile, Gasper says with the exception of the theft of some tribal flags recently, things have been peaceful, but they are protecting themselves.
We have our security forces out here at night, stuff watching everything, and we have cameras.
Gasper says everyone's welcome to tour the camp and walk their trails.
That's Mike Simonson reporting. During this week in 2011, the White House hosted a lacrosse clinic as part of the Let's Move in Indian Country initiative. Native youth were among those learning about the sport from players, including the Iroquois Nationals team. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
And by Humboldt State University, part of the California State University System, offering a part-time 3.5-year online Master of Social Work program emphasizing work in rural and indigenous communities. Learn more at humboldt.edu/socialwork. Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation is seeking to fill 2 positions in our national studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico. We are accepting applications for a senior producer for Native America Calling and resource development specialist to sell underwriting. Full job descriptions can be found at nativeamericacalling.com. Click on employment.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
Yeah, it's 5.5 minutes after 3, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My first 2 guests in the studio with me here are 2 lovely ladies from 2 bands. And the cool thing about these 2 bands is that everybody in each band is a member of the family. So it's these are 2 family bands. The Alaska String Band, of course, the Zahaskis here, and everybody knows who they are in Juneau. And then from Lebanon, Missouri, a group that they met down in Texas on tour, and that's the Link Union Band. So welcome to Laura Zahasky and Rachel Link.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. So are they showing you a good time in Juneau?
Yes. We went and hiked to the glacier today.
Oh, okay.
That was awesome. Uh-huh. And yesterday I went up Mount Eagle Crest.
All right.
That was awesome.
Eagle Crest.
Yeah.
And yes. And we tried to go whale watching, but they were hiding and camera shy. So we didn't see any whales.
Yesterday, Ashley, another member of the group, she asked me, she's like, what time do the whales come out in Juneau? And of course I told her, they're only out at 2:30. She goes, any other time you will not see whales. But then we didn't see any. So
that
is partially true.
Okay. Well, this is the season when the whales are a little bit shy.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
they were sleeping.
Well, probably so. Well, you're going to do a whale of a concert, I guess, here. So what's the plan? You're going to take over the Jack, and you're going to have 275 people on stage.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
Okay.
80 kids in each family.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
Stage crew is going to be amazing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So now for reality. How big is the Husky band?
Oh, there's 5 of us, my parents, and then my brother, sister, and I.
Okay.
And then in the Lynx, there's 5 kids.
Yes.
And then Ashley.
So, mom and my dad, and there's 5 kids, and my brother is married.
Uh-huh.
So it's like 6 kids.
Okay.
And then, so we just have a lot of fun. It's awesome.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So family band, when we do the Folk Fest here in town, there's a lot of family operations that show up down there, but not an organized band that's been around for a while. How long has the Zahasky family done this?
Well, we've been playing full-time musically for about 5 or 6 years. And before that, it was a few years where we just kind of played in the living room, did the Folk Fest thing once a year, and then... A few years after that, my dad quit his full-time job, and we bought a bus and went on the road. And we've been doing it for about 5 or 6 years full-time. And that's actually how we met Link Union. And how long have you guys
been?
That
story is almost exactly like ours, except we've been doing it for 10 years, and then full-time for 7 or 8 years, I think.
So what do you play?
I play the mandolin, just like Laura.
Okay.
Her and I are a lot alike because
we're the oldest
of each family,
yes.
And girls and mandolin players.
And awesome.
I got to tell the audience, I got to tell on you a little bit. So they're in here in the studio for about like 10 minutes before we actually went on the air, and it's like watching two maybe cousins who haven't seen each other for a long time.
Yes.
The way they talk to each other.
We have a lot in common.
Yeah, you are amazingly together, the two of you. That's going to blend the music really well. So you're going to do separate gigs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so each band will be up.
Yeah, each band will play for about an hour.
Okay, and then the plan is to bring Gargantua to the stage.
To let the children loose and combine the bands.
Chaos will reign.
Chaos will reign. Have you picked out the song, or you just kind of let it happen?
A big list of possibilities.
We have a list of about 55 songs right now.
Yeah.
It's going to be hard to pick
one.
It
is, but we are going to do some. It's going to be really fun.
Yes.
The question that immediately comes to mind is, I'm thinking of my family and what would happen if we were all to pick up musical instruments and try to play together, and it would not be pretty. I just know it would not be pretty. So how does the dynamic work out?
Well, we were born, and they said, you have to be in the band.
My mom and our family, the Link Union, she's always been involved in music, and so she started as kids out on piano when we were real small. And then we were interested in other instruments, and so that we would use what we were learning, she would take us to a nursing home once a week, and we would put on a little performance. And then it just started growing into adding more band members as the kids got older. Everybody likes music. Mm-hmm. It's not like we force it on the kids or anything.
Yeah.
So now,
they just like it.
Are you like they are? Are you full-time?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so we do this year-round. We're only in Missouri like 20% of the year.
Yeah.
So you live in a bus? Yes. Like they do.
Yeah, we have a 45 giant red bus. You'll have to come to the track and see it. We ferried it here to Juneau.
Okay, so now key question. Do you have your own room?
I do.
She does.
I am the only lucky member.
Because I do not have my own room in our bus. I get the couch.
Poor Laura. Yes, I am very spoiled with that.
There are so many questions. I mean, who picks the material? Who decides which direction the band's going to go? Is it like a family? Do you have a big family meeting? Or do you fight and whoever wins?
We kind of have a
survival of the fittest.
I sit down before a tour and just kind of pick out what our message is going to be, what we want to emphasize, and then try to pick songs that go with that.
Yeah.
And then if there's a song everyone just loves, we learn it and figure out how to work it into the program.
Yeah, it's like that with us. Everybody brings something to the group, which is neat because we all have different interests. And so my dad will pick a song, and then I'll pick a song, and then Quinn will pick a song. And we write quite a few songs. And kind of like what you're saying, you know, we have a core message that we want to give, but then we just have a lot of fun with it.
So yeah. I'm looking at across – I'm familiar with the Zahasky stuff. And your range is really wide.
Yes.
I mean, there's one CD that I've listened to, and you go all the way from really heavy rock and blues down to you know, serious gospel and like that. And it's really a range.
So, it is, yeah. And recently we've been getting into some jazz and some old pop and swing, and it's just a blast.
Yeah. Okay. So the concert is at 7:30 Sunday night at the Jack, and everybody's heard the Zahaskys, so you don't get any music on this one.
Okay.
But nobody's heard Link Union in town, so let's close it out with some of your stuff.
Awesome. That'd be great.
Right.
Thank you.
7:30 Sunday night at the Jack. Tickets on sale at the usual suspect places.
Yep.
Laura Zahasky, Rachel Link, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Come ringing o'er the restless waves in the line,
in the line,
in the line. There are souls to rescue, there are souls to save, in the line,
in the line,
in the line,
in the light,
the blessed gospel light, let it shine from shore to shore, in the line, and let its radiant beams light the world forevermore.
Everywhere all bounds in the light,
and a Christ-like spirit everywhere be bounced in the light,
in the light,
in the light,
the blessed gospel light,
let it shine from shore to shore,
in
the light, and let its radiant beams light
the world
forevermore.
For a crown above, send the light, send the light,
send the light,
shine.
Let the gospel light, let it shine,
shine.
From shore to shore,
send
the light, let its radiant beams light the world forevermore.
Thank you.
Music by the Link Union Band. They're going to be Sunday at the Jack along with the members of the Alaska String Band. Good concert. Take it in. Sunday night, 7:30. Tickets are on sale all the usual places.
Something's cooking at the Jack. Every Friday night from 5:30 to 7 p.m., there's live music, food, and fun at Food Truck Fridays. Anything from big band to poetry slam to Scottish Highland dancing. An event for families, friends, and neighbors. It's going to be a sizzling summer. Food Truck Fridays, 5:30 to 7 p.m. at the Jack. This message is brought to you by the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council.
It's just 15 minutes and 40 seconds after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My next guest is here to tell us about a very exciting new business that is operating in Juneau, the Aurora Project, Project with a K, and Scott Baxter is here. Scott, what do you guys do?
Well, we pretty much, it's all custom. We've actually been around for a little over 4 years now, and we're open year-round, and we're working with local friends and artists to do all our design work, and it's, you know, people come in and pick their own designs that we have, and they get to pick their colors, their color of shirt or sweatshirt. We can resize the design.
So these are shirts and sweatshirts?
Shirts, sweatshirts. Okay. We stickers, car decals. You probably see them all over on cars all over town. So that was kind of the gist of it. But we're also now doing a lot of silk screening, too. And so we're starting to take on a lot of outside business, other companies and school district stuff. So we've been doing that, too. But the Aurora Project itself is kind of a brand that we started here about 4.5 years ago.
Okay. And this is 12 local artists, right, who are more than that?
There's more than a dozen, yeah. I think there might be close to 15 to 17 artists, whether it's one design up to, I think a couple of them maybe have half a dozen designs or more.
Who's your primary target? Who are you trying to sell to?
You know, I think we started off, me and my buddy Shane Robinson, actually, we were the ones that started it. He got the machine that we're using, and I think we kind of threw Project in the name as a sense of not really knowing exactly where it was going to go. We didn't really have a target. I think it was just an idea.
Where are you physically located?
Right next to, we were renting the corner shop from the Alaskan Barn Hotel.
Okay.
So it's a tiny little shop.
Yeah, so you're right down there in the area where many of the people who come off of the tour ships come in.
Yeah.
Are they coming into your shop?
Yeah.
Are they looking at your stuff? Are they buying from you?
Yeah, we get a lot of tourism. A lot of people walk in and really like to see something different compared to all the other T-shirt companies downtown. So, I think they like the idea that they can design it themselves and walk away with their own custom, possibly, one that's never been made that way before. So I think it's pretty fun for them.
So they can choose the design in the store.
Yep.
And then you lay the T-shirt up and press it onto the thing and while they wait.
Yeah, they could come back. It takes 10 minutes or less, unless we're totally slammed. But we could produce them pretty quick.
Okay.
Yep.
Are the locals coming on to you as well?
Yeah, actually.
You said you're doing car decals and people are driving around with them around.
Yeah, I'd say most of our business is probably local. I mean, part of it is, we're open year-round. And I think what's fun for the locals, too, is, I was born and raised here. And, there's been some great skateboard, snowboard shops here in town and other shops where, people, next thing you know, you're wearing the same shirt that your buddy is, maybe.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's hard if you're not making them yourself. You get them made elsewhere, but you got to do a run of the same color shirts with the same design. And, so it's kind of hard being local and seeing, four or five other guys wearing the same exact shirt. So I think when we started doing this, it's been fun for locals that they could come in and maybe it's the same design as their buddies, but more than likely it's the colors are totally different or the placement's different or something about it's going to be more unique than the other person's.
You're wearing a shirt with a claw.
It's a wolf paw.
I'm hard to describe.
Native wolf paw.
Okay, in yellow on a gray background.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, is this one of the designs by whom?
Shane Brown.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Actually, was one of the first artists that we got involved with, and he's a younger kid from Yakutat, and he's done numerous designs for us.
So this is a native theme. Are you doing other?
Not all of them, but yeah. Okay. I mean, we definitely have some great native designs too.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I have some questions. You said you grew up here. And so you went to school here, right?
Yeah.
So when you were in high school, were you thinking about doing this kind of thing? Were you
no.
Were you entrepreneurial back then? Or
no.
Did this just come over you?
I can't say I was. I think this just kind of came about. I actually, for quite a few years before this, did a lot of filming here, you know, snowboarding, surfing out in Yakutat, snow machining, and I put together some of my own videos. And my buddy Shane Robinson, he's business partner, but he kind of mostly focuses on, he's a Red Bull distributor here in town, but he used to own Poseidon Snowboard Skateboard Shop, and he would notice that he could not hold his shirts down. He would get an order his Poseidon shirts, and they would fly out the door.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was, you know, people like to wear, local people like to wear something that's going to represent Alaska or Juneau, especially when they go travel. Well, he shut down the shop, and a few years after that, he saw this machine that we're using now, and he kept, you know, I'm gonna get one of those machines. You know, we need to make our own shirts and this and that. And I told him I knew my way around some editing programs, Photoshop and stuff, and that was part of what it takes to run this machine. I told him that, well, if you get the machine, you know, we'll figure out how to use it.
Yeah.
And one day he's like, I ordered the machine.
So and your whole life changed.
It took me a while to figure out how to use it. In the matter, like 6 months later, we actually just happened to get into that little spot, and we didn't have a lot of designs and didn't really have a full game plan. It was on an April that we opened right before tourist season, and it just, you know, it just went from there. It just kind of snowballed. Had no idea exactly what it would do, you know. And then we just started taking in more designs and other artists getting involved. And it's kind of been, yeah, a project.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why the K?
We thought of a Roar project. I think it was actually maybe him and his girlfriend that were talking about it. But we were all sitting around talking about a name. And they mentioned, I was like, yeah, that's a great name. And Aurora, of course, for the Borealis being up here, and Project, just, you know, kind of a project in its own sense. And so we got online and looked up WWW Aurora Project, and it was already taken.
And, of course, it was gone. Yeah.
So we took the C out and put a K.
Okay.
And it's, you know, just be a
and
little
the
different,
search
too.
Worked,
so,
and it didn't
yeah,
show up.
Yeah. That was that. So it's kind of taken on a life of its own, you know.
Yeah.
There wasn't any business plan or anything when we went into it. It just, we started real small.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and the shop itself is still real small, but we're doing a lot of good things out of it, so.
What's next?
Next, you know, right now, thinking of ways to expand. We actually got a new location, a lot, you know, it's mostly for production, but we're starting a silk screen. We have a 6-head silk screen machine, and we could take on a lot more multicolor and detailed designs now. You know, I have a lot of people that come in and want their own stuff, not even necessarily a Roar project, but,
yeah.
You know, we have school district coming to us and like, you know, we want to do some basketball shirts with this design. And, well, now we could accommodate for a lot of these other designs that we maybe couldn't do before because we were doing a lot of just one color, more simple designs.
Yeah.
So we're trying to get into more silkscreen stuff and do small runs for us, but then branching out, you know, doing other stuff for other people.
Sounds like a real opportunity for Junoites as well as our visitors from outside to find something totally unique about
yeah.
Juno and take it home with them or wear it around town with pride.
Yeah.
What's the address?
171 South Franklin Street.
171 South Franklin Street. Drop in and see Scott. See what you can do about a t-shirt. Thanks for coming on and tell us about it.
Hey, thanks a lot, man.
When the light is low and the day is done, Aurora dances down. When she finds the land that burst for sun, Aurora dances down. When the stars are up and the moon is dark, Aurora dances down. When the night leaps out like a fiery spark, Aurora dances down. Oh, she'll spin and turn and chill and burn till your knees fall to the ground. She wears the starry crown when the moon and sun are joined as one. Aurora dances down. Oh, the voice will still and the heart will leap. Aurora dances down. As the midnight watch we keep, Aurora dances down. Every human, bird, and beast, Aurora dances down. All partake of the swirling feast, Aurora dances down. She'll spin and turn and chill and burn till your knees fall to the ground. She wears the starry crown when the moon and sun are joined as one. Aurora dances down.
So Project Aurora, down on South Franklin, drop in and see Scott and take a look at some of these unique designs that he has as well. It's time for Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, July 12th, 2013. It's the birthday of the man who said, "I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, and see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover I had not lived." That's Henry David Thoreau, born in Concord, Massachusetts in 1817. He grew up exploring the woods and fields of Massachusetts. Encouraged by his mother to learn as much as he could from nature, he went to Harvard, didn't like it very much, and refused a diploma since it cost $5. He worked for a while in his father's pencil factory and as a public school teacher and became close friends with Ralph Waldo Emerson. In 1841, the Emersons invited Thoreau to live with them and work as a handyman and gardener, and he helped take care of their children, taking them on nature walks and telling them stories. Thoreau stayed with the Emersons for 2 years, and during that time he worked on his writing, and through Emerson became friends with many of the Transcendentalists. In 1844, Emerson bought land on the shore of Walden Pond, a pristine 61-acre pond surrounded by woods, and Emerson agreed to let his friend live on the land and build a cabin there. People often assume that Thoreau went out into the wilderness to write his famous treatise on nature, but in fact he was living less than 2 miles from the village of Concord. He had regular dinners with friends, continued to do odd jobs for the Emersons, and had frequent visitors. The book he was so committed to writing at Walden Pond was called A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers, about a trip he had taken with his brother. He finished it and published it himself, but it was a flop, selling fewer than 300 copies. But during the 2 years he was at Walden Pond, he also kept a journal, and after he left, he put it together as a manuscript. In 1854, he published Walden, or Life in the Woods, which has become a beloved classic. It's the birthday of the man who brought us the Kodak camera, George Eastman, born in Waterville, New York. He worked at a bank before he got interested in photography, and the first photograph he took with the camera he invented was a view of the building across the street from his window. He called his little handheld camera the Kodak because it was easy to remember, difficult to misspell, and it meant nothing, so it could be associated only with his product. And here's a poem by Richard Wilbur titled Leaving. As we left the garden party by the far gate, there were many loitering on who had come late, and a few arriving still, though the lawn lay like a fast-draining shoal of ochre day. Curt shadows in the grass hatched every blade, and now on pedestals of mounting shade stood all our friends, iconic, now in mien, half lost in dignities, till now unseen. There were the hostess's hands held out to greet, the scholar's limp, his wife's quick-pecking feet, and there was wit's cocked head, and there the sleek and gaze-enameled look of beauty's cheek. We saw now, loitering there, knee-deep in night, how even the wheeling children moved in a rite, or mask, or long charade, where we, like these, had blundered into grand identities, filling ourselves as sculpture fills the stone. We had not played so surely had we known. Leaving, a poem by Richard Wilbur from his New and Collected Poems, published by Harcourt Brace and Company, and used here by permission on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. This is Billy Collins hoping you will join us the next time on the Writer's Almanac.
It's just almost 3:30. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Chris Bernard has written an incredible book called Chasing Alaska, subtitled A Portrait of the Last Frontier, Then and Now. The book is a combination of two people's adventures in Alaska, one the author himself, but far more important or of equal importance in many cases, his ancestor, Captain Joe Bernard, who turns out to be quite a fellow. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, thanks for having me,
Pat. Hey, thanks for joining us. Chris, you're sitting in a hotel in Seattle, as I understand it, right?
I am.
What's your weather like down there?
It's mild. It's nice.
Ah, okay. Well, we're having a 60-degree day here with mostly cloudy skies, isolated showers. So it's Juneau all the way. I'm sure you remember that. Chris lived in Sitka, I think, for a few years, worked for a newspaper down there.
That's right.
So the book is a combination of a couple of things. One is the fact that you came to Alaska kind of searching for yourself and searching for something, and in the process actually discovered that you were coming to a place where your ancestors had been.
That's right. I thought I was the first Bernard in my family to move to Alaska. It turns out they beat me by 100 years, so I wasn't even close.
There's a wonderful line in there that I'd driven my pickup 7,000 miles and parked on one of my ancestors. I like that.
That's right. Shortly after I moved there, my dad found out that this collateral ancestor, Captain Joe Bernard, had left Prince Edward Island in Canada. And all we knew was that he had been an explorer in the Arctic and that he had tried to sail the Northwest Passage, and nobody knew anything more about that, and that was enough to get me intrigued, as I imagine it would anybody else.
So this guy is, he turns out to really be amazing, because he built his own book called The Teddy Bear, named it because a woman basically almost dared him to name it that, and and proceeded to do very un-teddy bear things with it, including being the first guy into a lot of places that are really cold and icy.
Yeah. He sailed the Arctic for about 25 years, but in all, he spent 10 winters frozen in there with the teddy bear locked in ice. And, you know, there were other kid contemporaries at the time, but he was unaffiliated with any government expedition or any university, so he really didn't have the training or the support or the PR team. So he's remained sort of a footnote in history because he didn't have the wherewithal to write the books to sort of celebrate himself as some of the others did. But his accomplishments were every bit as impressive or more so in many cases.
In many cases, he was the first guy before the ones that we read about in the books, right?
Yeah, I had a great laugh reading through Diamond Jeunesse, the famous anthropologist who was part of the Canadian Arctic expedition, would time and again mention in his book that he'd sail into a bay thinking he was the first white explorer there, and they'd all come down clutching their rifles that Joe Bernard had traded them and shaking hands and the custom that he'd taught them.
Yeah. Yeah, there were so many places in there where the humor of this situation came through, but Bernard really did some wild stuff, like deliberately let the boat let the ice stove in the hold of the boat so that it would fill with water and freeze so that it would safely weather the winter, and then roll it up on its side and patch the hole in the spring when it started to sink in the water.
You have to have some confidence in your own skills and in possibly, in his case, a higher power to be willing to sink your boat when you're, you know, in the Arctic.
When it's your way out, yeah.
Right, in 1909, you know, thousands of miles from anything.
Yeah. A clever fellow with very little bits of material as well. I remember at some point you're talking about him having patched the boat with some metal that he found and some canvas that he tore off of somewhere else on the boat.
It's not even that. It's in the 20s. He had retired from exploring the Arctic and he was chartering his schooner for passengers, and sailing on the way to Seattle, they got blown off course and they wrecked on the coast of Siberia. So he kept 22 passengers alive throughout the winter and then repaired the hull using whale rib bones and a mattress.
Yeah.
And the idea of patching a hull with a mattress and rib bones and keeping 22 passengers alive was just astonishing to me, but it speaks to the kind of competent, able man he is. And I think there are a lot of people like that in Alaska, and that's one of the things that really stuck with me when I left that place, is just it's a state full of remarkable people.
Well, now, I understand that you clarified, you know, as we were talking before the interview, that you did not consider this a memoir. But one of the most interesting things I think that goes on in this book is, as you discover more about Captain Joe's life, you're also at the same time discovering more about yourself. And I think that really makes the book alive, because the contrast between your view of present-day Alaska, because the book opens in Sitka several years ago, but then the later chapters are actually about the very recent past. And the way in which you start to kind of understand the parallels between your life and Captain Joe's, I think, is really eye-opening to the reader.
I appreciate that. I certainly didn't set out to write a memoir, although there are elements of travel memoir in this, but I really I didn't want to write an academic, scholarly account of Joe Bernard's time in the Arctic or of Alaska. I really wanted to include all those things, and I think to do that, I needed people to see it the way I saw it. And throughout that process, you know, learning about Joe as I was fumbling my way around Alaska, trying to learn how to run boats and to hunt and fish and just to be an Alaskan, for lack of a better way to put it, I was humbled by the people around me who were so good at it. And I was humbled as I was reading through 1,000 pages of journals that he'd left behind about these, you know, incredible adventures that he'd had. But I was just terrified of these simple things that people face every day. And it made me realize that somewhere along my bloodline, we must have been deluded, because I just did not have these genetic abilities that he had. But what I was able to do was the one thing that he was not. He worked for 60 years to edit his manuscript in hopes that he could tell his story, not because he was seeking fame, but because he really loved the land. He loved the Arctic. He loved the people of the Arctic, and he wanted these cultural observations to be recorded so that this would not be lost. And I was able to, you know, all the things I failed at that he succeeded at, I was able to help tell his story. And that was my goal, not to write my own story. But I think it was important, and I think it was inextricable. You're right.
You got the book there with you?
I do.
I said that you should choose a reading, but while you were talking, I realized that there is one that brings this book together in one chunk. Could you turn to page 262?
I can. 262, sure.
Yeah. About there where you're talking about at the far end of the deck, in the middle of that paragraph, in the middle of the page, if you put that together all the way to the end where you realize what's been going on with you, I think it will show the people that are listening to you what your craft looks like, and it'll also show you the place where you two come together in this thing.
Sure. Should I set it up a bit?
Yeah. Yeah, please.
So I came back to Alaska and spent a fair amount of time up there just traveling around the state and meeting some of the people and spending time with them. And one of the people that I spent time with was Bill Bernard up in Cordova. And he's a direct descendant of, he's a descendant of Joe Bernard, and he's living on Joe's land up there. And Bill and I went to find the remains of the schooner Teddy Bear that, you know, Joe's schooner from all his time in the Arctic. And this chapter picks up where we are on our just about to find it. So this is us at Joe's cabin. At the far end of the deck, an old sharpening wheel sits waist high on asymmetric wooden posts, a short axle through its center. The axle is rusted and the wood is rotting, the posts capped with moss. Weeds devour the structure from the ground up. Joe would have used this to keep an edge in the saw, chisels, rasps, and planes he used in his boat shed. Behind the deck, weeds have also overgrown a small clearing surrounded on three sides by forest. The entire property feels unkempt. Not wild, this is someone's home at least part of the year, and that someone has made efforts to tame the land, but much of the property has been neglected. Hicks surveys the scene like an investigator, and I study it like a reporter, but Bill traipses across it, his extra tufts buried deep in the wet grass, and disappears into the shadowy trees. "She's back here somewhere," he yells. I follow him into the canopy of trees and wait for my eyes to adjust to the darkness. A few lazy mosquitoes hang in the air. A squirrel chatters from a spruce branch. But the teddy bear has gone to rot isn't news. 8 decades of rain, snow, and neglect have gone a long way toward reassimilating her timbers with the earth where they grew. At the Cordova Museum, a few photos show her cradled here. In one, she's recently retired, high and proud and dry. In another, decades have passed. Her soft hull, already collapsed as planks peel from her ribs. I didn't expect to see a structurally sound sailboat standing tall on her keel, but nothing visible is even remotely boat-shaped. No cradles, no jacks, nothing but trees, weeds, and moss, so thick you'd need a hacksaw to cut through it. Have I come all this way for nothing? For years, the teddy bear has lived not as an actual wood and iron boat, but as an idea in my head, alive only in books and Joe's journals, tangible only in the photos I've gathered in which she forever sails, battered, scraped, but sound, through the frozen Arctic, frozen in time. I can't touch her. I can't run my hand along her rails, wrap my knuckle against her planks, or clamber over her decking to stand where Joe stood. Just being here is enough, I tell myself. It has to be. Here she is, Bill yells. I exhale and realize I've been holding my breath. Who was I fooling?
What a wonderful set of images. And it really serves at that point in the book, this is right at the end, to bring us full circle from your discovery at the beginning of the book that there's this guy that you're related to who is literally one of the authors of the book of the history of the North, not literally, but in person. And then at the end, when you finally come to this, and I should give away a little bit more of the book if I can, and that is that you took scrapings from the hull, and when you built your own boat, you actually incorporated them into the glue that you used to glue up the wooden boat you built.
Yeah, that's right. I think that moment serves as sort of the two parallel lines. It turns out they weren't running entirely parallel because this is where they connect. And I call that moment my handshake with Joe Bernard because up until that point, he'd only been, you know, a voice in his diaries. He'd only been a man in pictures and in my mind. And after all these years of research, I was actually touching something that he'd touched and standing on something that had been such a part of his life. And then incorporating that into the boat that I built to sort of better get a sense of what it was like for him, I think that just sort of keeps us together and allows him to live on in a way and the teddy bear to continue sailing. And I'm just thrilled that I was able to do that.
Chris, you got to come up here to Juneau and sit down in one of our bookstores and read some of this stuff and sign my copy of the book.
I will do that. We're looking into making that happen next year.
Well, good. I hope it does, and I want to be one of the first to know. The book is called Chasing Alaska, folks. It's a portrait of the last frontier then and now. Chris Bernard, he writes under the name C.B. Bernard. I checked around town, and it is for sale in our local bookstores. So go out, find a copy, and read it before he comes up here so that we can have an intelligent conversation with him. Chuck, thanks for taking some time out of your day down there in Seattle to read to us and to tell us the story of your book.
Thanks for having me, Pat.
I really enjoyed talking with you. See you later.
Take care.
This is Bird Note. Conserving habitat for birds is not easy. It requires knowing what you're talking about and building partnerships. Jim Brown, who was instrumental in establishing an Audubon Important Bird Area along 25 miles of the Clark Fork River in Montana, explains.
Well, one thing that's grown out of our attention to the Important Bird Area is the county planners respect what we are telling them, and we stick to our guns, and we talk about the birds that we know exist there and the science behind what they require to live. So we've been asked now to review all subdivision proposals in Missoula County, which we do, and in many cases testify at county commissioner hearings. The land developers now have taken on a new respect for the bird resource, and we've had several occasions where they've called us ahead of time to talk about the impacts on the birds. That's the best way to deal with it, is up front before the proposal is ever submitted to the county. Most landowners are quite interested to know what birds occur on their land it's easy to develop a conversation if you begin with the birds and their habitat and what's there. Conservation is largely about building relationships and trust.
To find out more about Audubon's important bird area program, begin at birdnote.org.
You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. It's just exactly a quarter of four. And this is Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon.
If you're a fan of Garrison Keillor, here's an opportunity you won't want to miss. KTOO is planning a special 40th anniversary trip to see a live broadcast of A Prairie Home Companion on September 21st. Our custom travel package includes 3 nights at the St. Paul Hotel, tickets to the show, ground transportation, a K2 reception, and a visit to Minnesota Public Radio Studios.
Proceeds benefit KTOO. Visit ktoo.org/anniversary to learn more.
My next guests are going to hopefully sort of build on us here. We have this new thing that's going on over at the Jack on Fridays. And what happens is it's called Food Truck Friday. So about 5:30 tonight, there'll be a number of outdoor eateries that are becoming popular all over Juneau this summer, particularly with all the good weather we've been having. We've seen more and more of them pop up out of places. So all of the food trucks will be gathered around, but in the middle of the food trucks will be an ongoing art show, and two of the artists are going to be here with me in the studio, and we're hoping that another will join us very shortly. Tom Cosgrove, whom I think everybody in Juneau knows, the storyteller, is here among us, and so he's going to be
Pat.
One of the folks here. Yeah, we've talked before on the air, Tom. So, and a fellow I have not met until just a moment ago, Dave Stout, who is. Are you actually bringing out your stuff and doing some flaming there?
Actually, this is my third year of selling.
Okay.
I've been doing this for about 6 years, and it took me about 3 years of practice, and so I finally, about 3 years ago, figured out that I can make some stuff that's marketable.
Yeah. Well, so Tom brought some samples of his work, and basically what it is it's shapes cut out of copper, and then he uses flames from what, an acetylene torch? Or?
Except I use propane. It's propane oxygen.
Okay. And this process then changes the color of the copper, the same as any flame will change, or any heat source will change the color of copper. So they really are quite beautiful. They're multiple colors of different shades and like that on the shape. I see a leaf and a bird and... what's the other one underneath there?
I have a salmon.
Oh, okay, and a salmon. Okay, cool.
Whale's tail, yeah. Moose.
And
I have about 15 different designs that I market.
Is a torch set up over there? Are you actually going to be?
No, they won't let me set it
up
over there,
won't
unfortunately.
Let you... Oh, okay, all right. Afraid you'll burn the jack down. Okay. So you're going to be telling stories in the midst of this chaos that is Food Truck Friday. So people get something to eat and then come in and sit down, and they're munching away and listening to you tell a story.
That's certainly the idea. And if you haven't been down, it starts at 5 o'clock.
Uh-huh.
Food trucks are open. The entertainment starts at 5:30. I'm the first one on tonight at 5:30. And so it's a fun thing. There's a lot going on. There's vendors, like we just heard.
Uh-huh.
And so, yeah, I'm gonna grab some folks and tell a few stories.
This is reminiscent of like a Renaissance fair almost. It's like, you know, the food is set up and people go from thing to thing, purchasing or eating or like that. All you need is strolling minstrels to.
Well, and I think they've been there. I mean, you've been.
I have. I've been there. Since they started it on the Friday, the first Friday of June,
uh-huh.
And oftentimes they have musicians come in, and they have different groups, different weeks.
Sure, they had the bagpipers there not too long ago.
Uh-huh.
I understand we've got the Jazzberries today, so as a matter of fact, it might be that Doug Bedillo will join us. He's the pianist with the Jazzberries. So last week, I believe they had the bagpipers and dancers, but they also, and I don't know who's on this week, you know, there's a simultaneous program that the Jack started, which is this thing that happens on Sundays out at the airport, where we have about an hour of music on Sunday evening, different musicians just set up down in there by the baggage claim area.
Yeah.
And the people who are waiting up in the TSA line get a little shocked.
Well, it's also, I think,
suddenly there's a jazz band playing downstairs.
The Jack is doing so many positive things. And I think, of course, this is the child of the Friday night concerts that would happen down in Marine Park.
Yeah.
And did for years. And with the change down at Marine Park and often fighting the rain, it moved down here. And I think other than, you know, not being right there and right in the middle of the cruise ships, it's a much better space. You know, you can do a lot more things with it. And I think it's becoming more and more popular. And when you have free entertainment of this quality and caliber, my gosh, why not come out?
Yeah, yeah. The combination is intriguing because Juneau is a town that has not had a reputation of good street food. Just a very few places, and the reason is because of our climate. I mean, for a good part of the year, it's really hard to try to run an outdoor street operation.
I've always been impressed with the summer selections.
But, man, this summer it's kind of taken off. I think some of it's due to this, that it's kind of like encouragement for people to open up. And there's suddenly more places than I've seen last summer, I think, floating around.
What vendors? What kind of vendors?
Yeah, who else is out there?
Well, there's a woman, her name is Bonnie. I don't recall her last name. And she sells vinegar and oils.
Bonnie Herbold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she does really well with her. Usually we sit up together. Really, really a nice lady. And there was a lady setting up as I came over who sells Alaska native crafts.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was setting up her booth. And it varies from week to week. Some of the local gardeners will bring their wares in and sell their gardening stuff.
I even saw a few that were selling stuff out of their station wagon, just knickknacks, you know, kind of a local eBay.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's arguing against that. It's I think they call that a mosquito market rather than a flea market here because of the nature of downtown Juneau. We just got joined by a third gentleman who walked in while we were talking here. Is this Doug Bedilla? Yeah, so pianist with the Jazzberries? Yeah.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay,
yeah.
So and you're one of the featured acts tonight as well?
Yes, yeah, one of three acts tonight, and we have a special guest, my daughter, who will be singing with us, and so I play the piano, keyboards, and we have a bass player, his name is John Sanchez, and he's a longtime resident here also.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he'll be playing bass.
So, piano, bass, and vocals tonight?
Piano, bass, and vocals, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So.
Hey, cool. So, what's the, which of the jazzes are you specializing in?
Well, it's good questions. We've experimented with a lot of different jazz from fake book jazz to sort of kind of soul jazz.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of right in there, yeah.
Okay.
And then, so we kind of have our jazz repertoire. And then we also have, we've been working on another repertoire of songs for there, kind of more geared towards dancing kind of thing. So the jazz stuff for, dinner parties and that kind of stuff, you know, quiet music, candlelight type music. So.
Anybody know who the third act is tonight?
I don't know the name. It's a group. It's a dance group, though.
Oh,
I do
okay.
Know
yeah,
that.
Yeah. Let's see. Yis Ku'u. And I have not seen them perform, but basically it means new people, new beginnings. And so they're the third act.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, we're covering it all.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think the only thing we don't have is we need someone who basically does total improv. You know, and that would. Of course, your stuff is sometimes close to total improv if you lose your place in the story.
I mean, a good storyteller gives you the impression that this is the first time
that you've been told.
Yeah. But the reality is, of course, it's a practice piece.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's been written and worked through. And part of the smoothness and power of a story comes from you know, spending some time with it
having
before
told,
you stand
having
up.
Told it more than once.
Yeah. Before you stand up in front of a group.
Yeah, I understand the process. Anyway, so what are you featuring tonight?
I'm telling a story. I did a road trip with my family a couple years ago, and I did a whole show on this road trip. And this is one of the stories that don't often get told, and it's basically a story of our trip into the Grand Canyon with bowel problems. So it's got quite a few humorous moments and not to be missed. I also have a story that I originally created for mudrooms, and if you don't know about mudrooms, it's a monthly storytelling event. Seven people, seven stories, 7 minutes, and they had a theme called Brush with Greatness. Mm-hmm. And this story came out of telling it at mudrooms, and it has since expanded a bit and got a bit more full. So not to be missed.
So I got to ask, as you're telling the story, you said it's a rehearsed piece, right?
Mm-hmm.
So as you're telling the story, will it be the same as the last time you did it?
If I do it well, no.
No. Okay.
Because if I'm working strictly from the script, then it sounds rote.
Right.
The trick is to, but every piece of the story builds on it. And literally there's an interconnectedness to a well-written story. And so to forget a piece can really screw you up. So the trick is doing it in order, but at the same time not using the same words.
Now, I want to extend that question two ways. First of all, when you're doing a piece, then is it what you planned when you started with the heat and the copper, or is it something that comes out of the process with the heat and copper?
Yeah, it comes out of the process. I usually have my iPad running on, and I have a couple of speakers in my garage, which is where I have my studio. And so I'm playing the music, and depending on what music and what my mood is, I'll attempt to get different designs. Obviously, the shapes are pre-cut. I have patterns to cut all the shapes out. I cut everything by hand on a scroll saw. So that's pretty well set. But the actual patterns on the piece is mostly comes from mood.
Okay.
And sometimes the weather.
And I want to extend that question now. So everybody knows jazz is improvisational, but the question is, do you sense the piece changing because of something that you're getting off the audience? Do you sense it because of the weather? Is it what? Where does the spark come to shift the piece?
Well, as far as today, I think the piece will definitely shift with my daughter Rebecca singing it, just because she sings it different than I would sing it, some of these songs. And so that brings a kind of a whole different flavor to the music. Certainly the audience can play a big part of it. As you look out in the audience and you see people really getting into it, you can kind of get an idea of what's really working and, you know, what's not. But a lot of the times you really have to kind of be prepared for anything. And then once you sort of get the basic framework, then you can kind of elaborate and ad lib from there. So, and then that can take a life of its own once you start performing.
I think what this captures is it captures the real beauty of this Food Truck Friday thing, because you pick up some food that you probably haven't had before, and then you go in and you're going to see a performance, and it's going to be live. So you're going to be a participant in that process. Whoever's telling the story, whoever's playing the music, whoever is creating the art, you become a participant. And that's really, I think, the strength and the wonder of this kind of event is each person who's in that room is really part of the entertainment.
There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
You're in tune with KTOO in Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas, and we also broadcast on a set of translators throughout the area. In the Valley and Auk Bay, we tune on K276AF at 103.1 MHz. Lemon and Schweitzer Creek hears us on K269AO 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM at 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS at 89.9. In Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau, digital channel 871. KRNN can be heard at digital channel 872, and KXLL can be found at 873. We're also online, continuously streaming at www.ktoo.org. Monday on KTOO's Juneau Afternoon, Annie Bartholomew will be the hostess. She's talking about an update of CBJ activities. Kim Kiefer will join her, the city manager. We'll learn about Monday night's presentation on nutrition and cancer by Stephanie Paver. And we'll also have the usual Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and a little bit more. That's all on Juneau Afternoon on Monday. Pat Morbin, your host today. Really enjoyed bringing you the show. And stay tuned now for All Things Considered.